Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the House Workforce and Business Development Committee. I call this meeting to order. And now, before I proceed, I just wanted to let you know that this hearing is being conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. And this remote hearing can also be viewed on the House webcast. With that, I just wanted to ask the legislative assistant to take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor, present. Vice Chair Jay Zhong. Vice Chair Jay Zhong. Lead Hamilton. Lead Hamilton.
Present.
Lead Hamilton, present. Here. Baker.
Baker, present.
Baker, present. Daphne.
Daphne, present.
Daphne, present. Frankie.
Present.
Frankie, present. Greenman.
Present.
Greenman, present. Haley.
Present.
Haley, present. Juergens.
Present.
Juergens, present. Kegel.
Present.
Kegel, present. Katiza Watun.
Katiza Watun, present.
Katiza Watun, present. Olson.
Present.
Olson, present. Tujong. Tujong. And Mr. Chair, Representative Jay Zhong is trying to get into the meeting. So he'll be here in a minute.
Thank you. Mr. Chavez, there's a quorum present. Members, if you can mute your mics before we get started. I would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes for February 17, 2021.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Jay Zhong moves the approval for minutes for February 17, 2021. Any discussions? Any discussions? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none. The motion prevails. The minutes for February 17, 2021 have been approved. Members, we do have three bills for consideration today. And I wanted to welcome Chair Eklund. I will move House File 672. To be laid over for possible inclusion in the Workforce and Business Development Omnibus Bill. Chair Eklund, welcome to the committee and tell us about your bill. Chair Eklund, you're muted.
You'd think I'd know that by now, Chair Noor. Sorry about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am here today with the Entrepreneur Fund, a nonprofit SBA micro lender and certified community development financial institution that does work all across northeastern Minnesota. Organization partners with entrepreneurs in Aiken, Benton, Carlton, Cass, Cook, Crow Wing, Itasca, Kennebec, Kuching, Lake, Mille Lacs, Morrison, Pine, St. Louis, Stearns, and Todd counties. In 2020, the Entrepreneur Fund was able to lend more than $20 million to small businesses here in Minnesota. Much of this lending has been for working capital and funding for business impacted by the pandemic, including restaurants and bars. The bill in front of you today, House File 672, would convert a current $1.148 million loan the Entrepreneur Fund has with the state of Minnesota into a grant. This would give the Entrepreneur Fund immediate leverage to access at least $10 million in additional lending for small businesses. The state's help in converting this loan into a grant will give the entrepreneur the ability to access millions more dollars to help small businesses. With me today are Sean Wellnitz, president of and CEO of the Entrepreneur Fund, and one of my constituents, Jessica Lights, owner of Boomtown in Hibbing, Eveleth, and soon to be in Duluth, and the Whistling Bird Restaurant in Gilbert. With that, I will turn it over to Sean, who will describe the situation and the merits of the bill.
Mr. Wellnitz, please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Great, thank you. My name is Sean Wellens. I'm the president and CEO of the Entrepreneur Fund. Thank you, Chair Noor, for the opportunity and the invitation. And thank you, Representative Olson and Representative Eklund, for bringing this forward and the support. Representative Eklund covered this well. The Entrepreneur Fund was given a pretty big responsibility in 2020, help make sure that all of our small businesses can survive, adapt, and thrive in the pandemic. We serve 16 counties in central and northeast Minnesota, and we bring the combination of consulting expertise as well as small business financing, particularly to those who can't access capital. And our purpose is really about community vitality and economic diversity. In 2020, COVID-19 really pushed our capacity. As you saw in some of your materials, on a typical year, we would work with about 900 small business owners. In 2020, we worked with 1,800 small businesses. And a typical year, we provide about 250 loans for $13 million, and we ended up doing 523 loans for over $20 million. Our average loan size was just $38,000, so this was a lot of really patient, flexible working capital for, as he covered it, it's childcare, bars, restaurants, retail. In fact, 43% of our loan portfolio are those who are hit the hardest, restaurants, hospitality, retail, and arts and entertainment. What we were able to bring during that time, and we can bring today, is a mix of expertise. We can bring HR expertise, we can bring technology expertise, we can help them adapt and make product and service changes, and we can bring some meaningful financial relief. We're able to do such things as forgivable loans, whether that was the DEEDS Small Business Emergency Loan Program. Right now we're doing a lot of PPP loans. We're able to provide debt relief payments to small businesses. So these are essentially, if you have a federal loan through the Entrepreneur Fund, as a small business, your payments are paid for the federal government for up to 8 months. And we can also offer them patient capital. So low interest loans, no payments for 6 to 12 months, just meaningful relief to help folks really get through the pandemic. So far, we've had a good success rate. Of the 1,800 small businesses we worked with in 2020, only 10 have closed. But we know that our work isn't done yet, and that's a lot why we're here today. We're uniquely positioned that we can provide these federal resources. We have relationships with these businesses who need it most, and we can deploy these funds really quickly. The issue that we have is really about our capitalization. So we have a very kind of simple formula that we have to follow. If we lend out $20 million, for example, we need $1 in equity, that's ours, the Entrepreneur Funds, for every $3 in debt. And those two pools together make up our total capital we can lend out. So effectively, we have to have like a 25% equity ratio. As we head into 2021, we have the debt capital lined up that we need. The issue that we have is the equity, which is why we're here asking for some support. Without it, we have to make some hard decisions with small businesses about who can and cannot get those things like forgivable loans, debt relief payments, or patient capital. Our demand for PPP is, growing by the week. We did 38 PPP loans just last week to the businesses we spoke about. And this legislation is really about, Representative Eklund covered it well, converting the $1,148,000 loan into equity. That will enable us to access a $10 million bond debt from the federal government. And our application will open up here in April, March or April, and close later in the summer. And we have to demonstrate to the federal government how we can maintain a 25% equity ratio, which is what we're seeking support in this bill to do. The loan that we have, to get a little bit into the weeds, the loan that we have with Deed right now came from the 2012 Jobs Act. It was funds from the federal government. Many states chose to grant these funds to CDFIs like the Entrepreneur Fund to really leverage additional resources like we're asking today. The state of Minnesota chose to really direct lending to CDFIs like us, and that once these funds are repaid to the state can essentially do as they see fit with it. And so we're asking today to allocate the specific amount to help us leverage additional capital for our region. So with it, I think I covered that in detail. We're in a great position to help. We're asking for this legislation to help us increase capacity and to kind of demonstrate some of the businesses that we help and that we work with. I do have Jessica Leitz here with us today, who is the owner of Boomtown Woodfire Grill in Eveleth and Hibbing, and I will either turn it over to her or I'll take questions at the chairman's direction.
We'll take the testimony from Ms. Litz. So welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Jessica Leitz. I'm the owner of the Boomtowns up here. We have two right now. There's one in Eveleth, one in Hibbing. We're in the process of opening one in Duluth that was projected to open actually last year around this time. And because of COVID, we're behind schedule. I also own the Whistling Bird in Gilbert. We started working with the Entrepreneur Fund back when we opened our second location in Eveleth, and without their help, I don't know that we would have been able to do it. We had a really difficult time getting funding when we started up. Banks didn't want to take the chance on us just because the restaurant industry has a high rate of failure. So they took the chance, and we've been partnered up with them ever since. They've helped us out in many different ways. Other than just giving funding for the restaurants, they've given us a lot of support. We actually received a startup grant from them too that put us in connection with a local, it's a 24-hour bookkeeper is what they're called. They helped us get all of our chart of accounts set up, do our QuickBooks. They actually did a lot of training with me, payroll services, all kinds of stuff. And throughout the years, I've had them on speed dial for many questions that have kind of arisen, and they've been there and they've offered support, training. And if it was something they couldn't help with, then they would tell me who to contact. And so we actually made a lot of valuable connections through the Entrepreneur Fund over the years. They were essential for our growth. They really were.
Go ahead. We had a little bit of a technical connection to you. Go ahead.
Fast forward to COVID, and they offered a lot of support to us then too. We ended up actually getting the forgivable deed loans for three of the restaurants. They also provided us with debt relief payments through the SBA for two of our locations currently. And that was huge for us. We were hit really hard by COVID. I mean, obviously we were shut down for a good portion of the year, or trying to survive on takeout only. So having that financing was really beneficial for us, but also just having them there to answer questions when we're applying for, you know, some of these forgivable loans or doing things that we haven't had to do before, and just letting us know what was available to us. Every time something changed or something else came out, they were always giving us a call or shooting us an email, always keeping us up to date and in the loop, and you know, pointing things out that we should be applying for or looking into. I think that really kind of sums everything up. Unless you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Thank you so much, Ms. Litz, for your testimony. Thank you for your resilience during a difficult time. We're here to stand with businesses, because small businesses are the economy of our state's engine. So thank you so much for the work that you do. Members, any questions for the bill author or the testifiers? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to put a shout out to Jessica. I just saw her first name. Sorry, I missed her last name. And thank you for being a restaurant operator. And as a former operator myself, I will tell you that the state is working super hard to try to get you all the help that we can. And I'm really proud, along with Chair Noor, that we worked really hard on the business relief grants. And at the end of the year, we hope that you were able to see some relief from that as well from the state of Minnesota. And again, many of my colleagues worked hard to make that come to a fruition. Maybe my question is, maybe for the author, my friend, Representative Rob Eklund, that this Northeast area, which is really critical to our state, if other areas don't have these type of same regional areas, Representative Eklund, how do we sort of justify more grants in this area and more forgiveness of loans that were previously set up as a loan? It gets a little bit sensitive to other regions of the state. And again, I want to help Jessica and her operation and Sean and your region. This is not like unreasonable, but we have other regions around the state. And I just wanted to sort of put it out there that how do we try to balance this out? Because through federal grants and federal loans and state grants and so on, we have to sort of try to now balance it a little bit around the state. I just would like any feedback on how do we try to defend this and if other regions don't have that same opportunity. So thank you again.
Thank you so much, Representative Baker. I think this question goes to the bill author, but at the same time, this is more of a leverage into more resources coming to the state, knowing that we have got entity that has done a good job in ensuring the continuity of services. I'll let Chair Eklund respond to that, or maybe also to Mr. Wilnitz. Go ahead, Chair Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker. I certainly am sensitive to if these type of things aren't available in other areas of the state. But if you take a look at the number of counties that I left read off at the start, I think there's about 20 that currently covers about a quarter of the state. I know I wasn't the best probably in math in high school, but I'm pretty close there anyway. So, but I think it's the biggest thing is the Entrepreneur Fund has shown what they can accomplish over the years. They've been in business for a long time with the original loan. And I think this is exactly like Chair North said, is to try to leverage more money to bring in Northeastern Minnesota.
Representative Baker.
Thank you. That was well said. Thank you.
Mr. Wilnitz.
Yeah, I'll just add too, I mean, I obviously work with my other peers across the state. I will say there's probably only a handful of us who are in this kind of same issue where, you know, we've grown and we've been aggressive on our lending to help these businesses. Not all of our peers have been. I will say this is a little unique to Northeast, or not to Northeast, to Greater Minnesota, where we don't have large corporate bank footprints. You've seen a lot more sort of corporate and philanthropic support within the metro. We just don't have that opportunity here in Greater Minnesota, especially I can say Northeast and Central. So I do think this is a little bit equitable in sort of serving the state and gives kind of a gives us an opportunity that otherwise we wouldn't be able to access.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Noor, members. I guess my question would be more for Mr. Wilnitz. I applaud the work that you're doing. I know that in my businesses, I also own a bar and a restaurant, and there have been little to no organizations reaching out to me. And I'm right here in the Twin Cities. So I applaud you for reaching out to the businesses in your area and working with them and getting them what they need. And so I'm just kind of wondering what happens to your organization if the loan is not converted to a grant, and will you still be able to provide the same level of services? Because I see some of these things personally where a lot of these organizations outstate, I think, are doing somewhat of a better job than the resources that we have here in the Twin Cities. And maybe because there is just so many more businesses that have to be reached in order to get this information out to. But where does your organization stand should this not happen or occur? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wilnitz.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I took a bit of a leap of faith this year. So, you know, I'm planning on, last year we did $20 million in lending. I'm assuming this year is going to be just as heavy, if not more. What I've done so far is I haven't held back on doing PPP loans or those kind of things. I've been aggressive on those in hopes that something will come to fruition for later. What will happen if we don't? I think what that means is we will probably have exhausted our loan capital on things like PPP or these deed, you know, the deed loans or other loans we partnered as patient capital, and we wouldn't have the financial resources to help, especially with the restart of these businesses, you know, when they're kind of looking to get back on or they want to go and scale back up. Because one thing we've seen in polling, even as I looked at PPP, a lot of our bank partners have kind of shed bars and restaurants from their portfolio. So if they don't have a resource like the Entrepreneur Fund, you know, we're going to be it. So we're going to have to say no to a lot of those folks when we get into mid-season and people are trying to ramp back up and they're trying to bring staff back on and they're trying to build working capital. That's where our pain point is going to happen.
Representative Frankie?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker, you've got a follow-up question?
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I wanted to maybe ask again our testifier, Jessica. Representative Eklund and I are actually working on a roadmap to recovery for getting businesses open. I'm not sure if you've kind of seen what that looks like, but we're really trying to find a stepped approach to get your restaurants back to 100%. I don't know if you have any event space or meeting space in any of your locations, but we just know that that's critical for businesses to have a stepped approach. And we are really working hard to try to get a bipartisan movement down here in St. Paul to kind of give the governor some advice and some actually direction, I think, to how is the best way to get you guys back to 100%. Because I think we sort of understand we can't just give it all to you overnight. It's not like ripping off the Band-Aid. I think that's maybe not the best approach. But could you just comment to the group here of a lot of bipartisan members that want to help you? What is it that we can do best to make sure that you open safely?
Ms. Litz.
That is actually a little bit of a difficult question. I think right now, the stepped approach is definitely important in my opinion. It's been really difficult because there's really no way to know what's going to happen next. And I think everybody is doing their best to plan as well as they can. But having a little bit of time ahead to kind of plan things out has always been really important, whether it's bringing more staff back on and, you know, hiring and training. Unfortunately for us, we lost a lot of people over COVID for one reason or another. Some people didn't want to come back because of the benefits. Some people just aren't comfortable or had underlying health issues, or just through the ups and downs of everything have decided to move on and get a job in another industry because they still have, you know, families to provide for, and they need to do what's best for them. So I think getting us back open, one of the things that we need is just a little bit of time to start hiring and training staff. And we've experienced a lot of difficulty staffing mostly. We've also had some issues with getting the products and supplies that we need and keeping the supply chains open, all of that. But really just having a plan and having it communicated with enough time for us to kind of figure things out is important. And I want to get back to 100% too, and I definitely want to do it safely, but there's a lot of things that we need to consider getting there. And that's a big one, is going to be taking the time to hire and train more people, and it's added expenses too. So.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Ms. Litz, for highlighting the challenges that we're all facing during this difficult moment as we deal with COVID-19. And thank you for also bringing up the issue of benefits and other challenges that you're experiencing and workforce development. Those are all issues that we're going to be discussing in this committee in the coming days before we move to the end of session. So hopefully we can agree on some few points on that. Members, any other question? I've got two questions for the testifiers. The question that I have is for the micro lending. I know I heard that you do micro lending. Are you receiving any support structure from the federal government as a micro lender? And how do you envision? Because I want to bring us to establishing micro enterprise to support small businesses who can be on the startup or existing entities. Mr. Wilnitz.
Just to clarify your question, you're wondering what those resources are or what they bring? I just want to make sure you understand the question.
So the first question is, are you receiving any federal funding for the micro enterprise as a micro lender? The second piece is we're looking into establishing a micro enterprise so that we can help those who are aspiring to start a small business, especially those who have less than 5 employees, as a roadmap for us to look into micro enterprise. From the introduction, Chair Eklund stated that you're a micro lender. Just walk us through just briefly on those two aspects.
Thank you. Yes, we are an SBA microlender. In fact, we rank usually in the top 10 of the country. There's about 130 microlenders across the country. And that's a little bit of why this bill is also so important for us. So the microloan program works where the federal government will make a loan to us, to the Entrepreneur Fund. We provide those loans back out. We make a little interest off of those loans, and then they provide us a grant to provide consulting to those small businesses. It's an awesome program for, actually Jessica shared in hers when she talked about the bookkeeper. That's how we kind of do that too. We'll make you a startup loan, we'll provide you with some consulting, and it's a fantastic startup tool. There is a lending cap in that program of $6 million that they will lend out to CDFIs like us. We just hit that max last year. Through the latest federal relief, they opened up another $4 million available to us. So again, I can access that debt, but I need the equity to show my other creditors that I can handle it. But it's been a very, we're huge fans, of course, by how we use it. So if you're thinking about the state of how to consider it, I think the federal program works well. It's just kind of figuring out how the state might be able to sort of leverage more participation in that federal program, because you have to be, as a nonprofit, you have to kind of scale it. I think you got to get to about, you know, you probably got to get to 25 loans per year for it to be viable, and a lot of nonprofits struggle to get there. But once you kind of hit that mark, the federal program, for us, it breaks even. I mean, it covers our costs, and it makes a lot of impact on those, as you said, five employee and under startups. It's an awesome resource. So it could be helping more people get into it, or in cases like us where we're bigger, helping us with the equity side so we can access more of the debt from the federal stuff that's available.
Thank you, Mr. Wilnitz, for your testimony. As I have heard, you do have a deadline for March, April timeline in order for you to secure the funding. It's something that we have to look into. How soon should we be getting this resolved? If you see the future in terms of when do we need to make the decision, Mr. Wilnitz?
Yeah, I think the timing of the session lines up well. So our application, this is a federal bond. So it's kind of a pass fail. It's not competitive. We just have to show that we can maintain 25% equity and that we can get $10 million in debt out the door in lending. We know that with this bill, we can show both. And so the opening we haven't got the opening yet. We're expecting it's going to open in March or April. It's based off federal appropriations. And then it will close. We're expecting the application is going to close probably end of June. And so we don't have to have the funds in hand. We just have to show them and explain to them how we're going to maintain that 25% equity. So if this legislation has, you know, traction to it and we share that, we have to show that proof by, I think it'll be by November, the end of the year, we'll have to really show that we have a hard commitment to really meet the criteria that we're looking for.
Thank you so much, Mr. Wilnitz. Any closing remarks, Chair Eklund, and I'll renew a motion after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Norr and members. This is a good bill that works with a lot of our small communities, small areas off northeastern Minnesota, and I just ask for the committee's support. I think they've done good work in the past, and with this bill, it'll help them leverage more money to be able to do good work going more into the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. I renew my motion. House File 672 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Workforce and Business Development Bill. So thank you so much, members. With that, we move to the second bill for consideration, that is House File 860. Representative Kotiza Watun, please move the bill and tell us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 860 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Thank you. So House File 860 has been moved by Representative Kotiza Watun for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 860 is a direct appropriation request for the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership for $212,500 in fiscal years 2022 and 2023 to provide pre-employment services statewide for displaced homemakers. Since 1978, the Family Resiliency Partnership, previously known as the Minnesota Displaced Homemaker Program, has been a trusted pre-employment and family stabilization program provided by a network of six regional partners across the state. It is the only program in the state that's specifically designed to help individuals address the unique barriers they face when trying to either enter or re-enter the workforce after abandonment, divorce, death, or disability of a partner. The program addresses work readiness by teaching program participants the essential life skills needed to stabilize their families after a transition and the necessary job-related skills to conduct a successful job search. In fiscal years 19 and fiscal year 20, 60% of the individuals served by this program were victims of domestic violence. 75% were not receiving child support as had been ordered by the courts, and 22% entered this program homeless. So this program serves a population facing multiple barriers of entry to self-sufficiency. The program provides excellent results for participants with a very minimal investment. The six programs regionally across the state are in Brainerd, Virginia, Waite Park, Minneapolis, Mankato, and Rochester, and they've been very good stewards of the resources that they have. Up until now, the primary funding source for this program has been a portion of marriage licenses and divorce filing fees. Due to significantly fewer people getting married during the pandemic, this program has seen a 23% cut in funding this year alone. So throughout the pandemic, this program has continued providing services without interruption, and the providers have practiced the resilience that they teach by making needed adaptations to serve participants and their families. So I think that this is a program that's well worth our investment. It's helping women and some men all across the state of Minnesota. And I think that I'm going to let my testifiers take over to share a little bit more about the program.
Thank you so much, Representative Cotizo Atun, for bringing this bill forward. So you have Ms. Keenan to testify on this bill. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jean Keenan, and I am a service provider with the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership. And some of you may remember us as having been the Displaced Homemaker Program, and we recently tried to update our name to have it be more relevant because the work continues to be relevant. So as Representative Katiza Watun was saying, and we would like very much to thank her for authoring this bill for us. We are a network of six providers statewide offering family stabilization and pre-employment services to individuals who need to enter or re-enter the workforce due to abandonment, divorce, disability, or death of a spouse. On your one pager, you will see a quote from a participant whose husband passed away and then from cancer, and then 6 short months later, she lost her job. She credits the program not only with helping her re-enter the workforce, she says the program helped her to survive. So reeling from one of these changes and without adequate income, some individuals see no alternative but to turn to the state for financial help, and it is our goal to interrupt that cycle. So every low-income participant diverted from public assistance saves the state $19,181 annually per family consisting of one adult and two children. So to create better outcomes for children, it is critical that we help their parents reach self-sufficiency. There are no other programs providing these services. This is a client-driven program that helps participants achieve a level of personal confidence and empowerment that will move them towards lasting self-sufficiency through the dignity of work. This wraparound comprehensive programming is voluntary and offered at no cost to participants. Each individual works with a provider to develop a unique action plan. It is not a one-size-fits-all program. We offer education to participants around essential transferable skills and help them develop effective job strategies, even assisting them with the computer skills needed to conduct a job search and to complete online applications. Finally, and I think most importantly, the program helps families to stabilize after a crisis by providing holistic and trauma-informed care. We teach participants to advocate for themselves. Funding for this program is administered through deed from a portion of marriage license and divorce filing fees, which have eroded significantly during the pandemic due to an unprecedented decrease in the number of people both marrying and divorcing. On January 1st, each of the programs were required to cut our program budgets by 23%. This is happening at precisely the time when our services are more needed than at any time in recent memory. The hospitality and leisure industry, as well as small retailers, were some of the industries hardest hit by the economic downturn due to the pandemic. Those industries were disproportionately staffed by women, and particularly by women of color. This program has the expertise and experience uniquely designed to meet their needs and to help them get back into the workforce. It is our understanding that when DEED sends out a request for proposals, $3,000 to $5,000 is generally considered an acceptable cost per participant. And according to DEED's formula, the cost per participant annually for our program was $1,498, significantly less than almost any other program. Our services are critical because those who participate in the program are often the unseen unemployed or underemployed who may not otherwise receive any kind of employment services. We're extremely grateful for the direct appropriation we received last biennium, and we really have worked hard to be good stewards of those dollars. Last year alone, we served over 4,300 participants and their families. Some of those funds allowed us to make the unexpected adaptations to continue providing services during this pandemic. We were able to purchase the technology necessary to provide virtual workshops and one-to-one services. We started or grew Chromebook lending libraries and purchased hotspots so participants could stay connected to support services and continue their job search. We were able to get PPE for participants and their children, and we're very proud to say that all of our services have remained available without interruption. We even met outdoors with participants when the weather allowed us to do so. A direct appropriation for the next 2 years is critical as a bridge to the marriage license and divorce filing fees stabilizing once again. It would allow us to maintain these life-changing services. Finally, it would provide direct support dollars for participants to eliminate barriers to their training needs or job search that are not covered by other providers, such as minor car repairs or gas cards or maybe a month's car insurance. In my 19 years with the program, I have had the privilege to witness literally thousands of program participants courageously rebuilding their lives and reaching self-sufficiency. Some of you may remember that I have been one of them. After the divorce from and later suicide of my son's father, my ex-husband, I desperately needed support to rebuild. I know firsthand that displaced homemakers can and do start over. I'm very proud to say that my son is completing his junior year at Georgetown University. Through the support and hope I was given, he was given hope and support too. Thank you again for your time and consideration of House File 860. And now I would like to turn things over to a former program participant, Stacey Gordon, to share her experience.
Thank you so much, Ms. Keenan, for sharing that. And welcome, Ms. Gordon. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing my testimony today. I am a little bit under the weather, so please forgive my voice. I hope you can hear me and understand me. My name is Stacey Gordon. Just a little bit about myself. I had been in an unsafe relationship and knew for the safety of myself and my children that I had to leave. I moved to the Brainerd area, not knowing anyone except for a few family members in the area. I didn't really have any support and felt lost. I was now a single mother of four young children and was desperate to be able to provide for my family and create stability in our lives. I found out about the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership Program and enrolled. From the first moment that I met with the director, I was showered with love, hope, support, something that had been lacking in my life. I was provided a supportive environment for me to pursue my education and career goals. I attended and benefited from the various workshops and support groups. The different activities and things we learned and discussed, such as grief support, self-esteem, goal setting, resume writing, job interviewing skills, communication skills, all of these which were very helpful to me. The computer lab there was extremely beneficial as well, as it was a quiet space for me to go and do homework and use it for job search. As I didn't have a computer at home and having four kids at home made it very difficult for me to get anything done. Because I lacked confidence and support, I felt like I didn't belong in college, and this program helped me to assimilate into the world of academia at Central Lakes College. One of the biggest goals that this program has helped me accomplish was getting my driver's license. I had had a lot of fear and anxiety about driving. This had always been a significant barrier for me. My four children and I walked everywhere we went, rain or shine, and though we did what we had to, walking in the cold was hard. I had little to no driving experience. The program director gave me the gentle nudge to finally take that step and take my road test. With the support and the newly found confidence in myself that I could actually do it, I passed my test. I am now a confident, independent driver. We no longer have to walk, take a bus, or bother anyone for a ride. It is such a huge freedom. I had no idea how big of an impact it would make on my family. Another major goal accomplished with the help of the program was getting a car. The program was very instrumental in helping me apply for a grant for a donated car. I was so very happy to be the chosen recipient. I can also now happily say that I'm a college graduate and I'm gainfully employed in a career that I love where I can help and support others to reach their goals and provide for my children and grandchildren who I am also raising. I am so grateful for the services that this program has provided and for all the support I was given. This program has helped me in so many ways and it has changed the course for my family forever. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Gordon. I hope you feel better soon, and thank you for sharing your story with us. Members, I see Lead Hamilton. You've got a question? You're muted.
I was just saying, well, thank you, Ms. Chairman. I was just saying I'm having problems with my connection here, too. So hopefully you can hear me okay. And first of all, to the testifiers, thank you so much for your testimony. It's always great to hear from people, and it's very impactful. I appreciate that. Ms. Keenan, you talked about the current funding source, and I understand that because of the reduction in marriages and divorces, I understand that is no longer sufficient at this time. Prior to that, was that your primary funding source, and was it sufficient and adequate prior to COVID?
Ms. Keenan.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton. We have had direct appropriations in the past at some small level because the program continues to grow and continues to be necessary. I would love very much to say we've just equalized the playing field and that people aren't falling behind, but we have seen that this pandemic particularly has really laid bare the inequities in our society. So we know that the funding will be critical to help, particularly when we've got single moms who, for whatever reasons, might have been pushed out of the workforce because they had to care for children who were distance learning. And so now they've got to dial back in and they're trying to manage multiple barriers. We have had a steady funding source with the marriage license and divorce filing fees, and we anticipate that it will return to that level, but we need a bridge to be able to get through what many people are looking at right now as a challenging time for our participants.
Thank you, Ms. Keenan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Keenan. Appreciate it.
Any questions, members? Don't see any hands up. So I just wanted to note that from the economic statistics that we were informed based on the data that we've been hearing, almost the net loss of employment in December data entirely were women. So we understand the challenges many women are facing in the face of COVID-19 and the challenges that we're facing all of us together. So I think this is something that we want to look into, and I, you know, look forward to supporting this initiative. Representative Tizotun, did you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your consideration and support of this program. Ms. Keenan and Ms. Gordon, you both should be very proud about the work that you've both done to support your family and to be a part of this community. And I appreciate it, and hopefully that we'll be able to help going forward.
Members, Representative Kutuzo-Witun renews her motion, House File 860, to be recommended to be added to the omnibus bill. With that, we do have the third bill for consideration today. That is House File 679. Representative Bolden, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed. I'm going to move House File 679 to be recommended to be included in the Workforce and Business Development Omnibus Bill. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Liz Bolden. I am a representative. I thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to join you today and to present House File 679. This bill requests continued funding for the Bridges to Healthcare program, which has been an important workforce development program in my home city of Rochester and our surrounding communities for a number of years. Given its success and positive outcomes, this program is now in the process of expanding to Albert Lea, Austin, and Owatonna. Bridges to Healthcare is a private-public partnership that helps non-traditional students transition to a lifelong career in healthcare. These careers provide a livable wage and benefits and helps meet the workforce needs of our healthcare industry while promoting diversity and inclusivity in our communities. Many of the students and graduates of this program are non-traditional students, perhaps older in age, first-generation students, or use English as a second language. The unique partnership of the program provides the pathway and support to allow students to gain the needed education experience in order to pursue professional training for available certifications and degrees. Over the past decade, this program in Southeast Minnesota has proven its success by enrolling more than 600 students in various certification and degree programs, and can now attest that more than 550 of its graduates have gained employment from more than 150 area providers, including Mayo Clinic and a number of long-term care providers. Examples of possible roles include, but aren't limited to, certified nursing assistants, patient care assistants, phlebotomists, home health aides, and now registered nurses. Given the success of this program in Rochester and Southeast Minnesota, which is proud to boast a 135% return on investment, the program is now expanding to the Albert Lea, Austin, and Owatonna communities. The request you have before you today seeks a funding increase from the Workforce Development Fund given this expansion. The program has received $250,000 each year for the last 4 years from the Workforce Development Fund. But to ensure sustained funding for the current operation and expansion to South Central Minnesota, House File 679 seeks an increased request totaling $475,000 per year. To share more about this great program, I am joined today by several colleagues. I'd like to introduce them and then invite them to speak, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that members may have at the end. Today, my guests include Ginny Reitman, who is the Executive Director of Workforce Development, Inc., Barb Embicher, who is the Vice President of Academic and Student Affairs at Riverland Community College, and Sue Du, who is a graduate of the Bridges to Healthcare program. And so with your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to invite Ginny to share more about the program.
Ms. Reitman, welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of the Bridges to Healthcare program. My name is Ginny Reitman, and I'm the Executive Director for Workforce Development Incorporated and the Workforce Development Board of Southeast Minnesota. WDI is a private nonprofit organization, and we provide employment and training services to a 10-county region in Southeast Minnesota. WDI serves as the fiscal agent and administrative agency for this program, which includes a number of private and public partners, as referred to earlier, such as Rochester Community and Technical College, Riverland Community College, Mayo Clinic, Hawthorne Education Center, which is our local ABE provider, and WDI. We also serve as the convener, joining partners together and serving as the liaison between the career seeker and the opportunities. We are well suited in this role, not only as a nonprofit community-based organization, but as a key leader in workforce programming in the state, and we have over 30 years of experience in addressing the needs of the economy and the region. The state is a key partner in this project, though, and we also have private support and funding. Our program started with funding from a TACT grant from the Department of Labor in 2011, and we've grown over the years to include a number of other partners and funders. Most recently, we received state funding through direct appropriation dollars since 2017. In 2019, we started discussions on expanding the program to other parts of the region due to recommendation from our local elected officials, and also because it was time to increase our impact throughout the region. We come before you today with a roadmap designed and ready to implement for expansion into Austin, Albert Lea, and Owatonna areas. Our overall project costs are $673,000 per year, which includes our expansion project to Austin, Albert Lea, and Owatonna. We've secured project partner and other funding totaling $198,000 per year, or 29% of the budget. So currently we have about a third of the funding that's necessary through other project partner funding. What we're asking you to support today is helping us further build a sustainable workforce program that serves as a win-win-win opportunity, as we like to call it, because we support individuals to economic security with livable wages and benefits. We help meet the needs of the workforce in the region, and we also increase equity in our community, expanding the tax revenue and lowering the costs of public supports. Increasing equity is also vital to our state and workforce programs, and I'd like to say that the Bridges program has an overall diversity percentage rate of hires of 79%, which is pretty astonishing for our region here in Southeast. In addition, 60% of the hires are going to support vastly understaffed long-term care facilities. This program truly is the perfect trifecta, supporting targeted populations entering the workforce, supporting private business and filling their workforce needs, and also increasing equity and the overall economic vitality of the region. We're thankful to Representative Bolden and our authors for their support of this program and the opportunity to speak with you all today. And I'd now like to introduce Barb Embacher, who is the Vice President of Academic and Student Affairs with Riverlane College.
Ms. Embacher, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Barb Embacher. I'm the Vice President of Academic and Student Affairs at Riverlane Community College. We serve a broad region across southern Minnesota. So happy to join our Rochester friends and share in their success in this program. We have done a lot of legwork already before we even came to you for this funding request. And we're excited to tell you that we have 90 students already in the pipeline at Riverland, working with the three adult basic ed partners in Steele, Freeborn, and Maurer County to really address these workforce shortages and help students, a lot of these adult students that either are new immigrants to our communities from other parts of the world or who are non-high school diploma graduates. So we have a lot of students in our region, thousands of them actually, that do not have a GED or a high school diploma that this program is perfect for. Many of them don't want to stay in minimum wage jobs the whole rest of their lives. Many of them are dependent on us right now, on the taxpayer, to support them in multiple programs. This is really a self-sufficiency, welfare-to-work type of program. And we've seen the success that Rochester has. So my colleagues in the Austin, Albert Lea, and Owatonna region are excited to roll this out. And our teachers have been hard at work already, partnering up to provide those basic English, math, and college readiness skills. As I said, we have 90 students already this fall and spring that we've been serving, and they are now ready to enter the healthcare programs of becoming certified nursing assistants, medical assistants, medical receptionists, all of those kind of jobs, phlebotomists, things that are a good stepping stone that they can do gradually. So we are very appreciative to this opportunity. We know that there are many things that we don't have to start from scratch. We can build on the coattails of what has already been a proven practice, best practice model in the Rochester community. Those folks have been sharing all of those things with us as we've been ramping this up. And we have a lot more business partners to involve in this project as we get going. So that will be a helpful sustainability factor in this long-term plan.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I think we have the last participant, Ms. Is it Sudo?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. You're muted. You're muted. Sorry about that. Unmute yourself. You're still muted. If you can unmute and proceed.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Sudu. I'm so glad I'm come be here to say something about the Bridges program. First of all, I appreciate this program giving me an opportunity to change my life and become better. I still remember when I started to come here, everything changed, different food, language, and culture. I was sad and almost isolated myself. I hid in the room, afraid to go outside, even went to the market to buy something. However, luckily, I meet a Burgess. The Burgess program have a long-term and a short-term program that give me a chance to march my life plan. For me, my first step was become a nursing assistant and got my qualification. I did not spend a long time, about 1.5 years, when I can work in the nursing house to experience how to care for, communicate with, and serve other people. I like to connect with people and could help them. And then the work experience helped me successfully apply for male phlebotomy program. Due this time, the Burgess approved helpful suggestion, financial aid, and get me step by step to realize my life career plan to become phlebotomist. Now I work in the mail. Thanks, Mr. Chair, for listening my story.
Thank you, Ms. Du, for sharing your story and the inspiration to many folks that they can really achieve success by having good programs like the Bridges. And I see Representative Haley with question, comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Bolden, for bringing this forward. I am quite familiar with the Bridges to Healthcare program, having worked with some of those partners in the past. And I appreciate that you and I had time to talk about this late last week. And so I just wanted to bring forward that I'm interested in expanding your bill to include Minnesota State Southeast in my region, as we are a significant Mayo partner. And we also have the programs for nursing and long-term care in those related fields at both of our campuses. Ms. Rittman and I have also worked together on a number of initiatives, and we're both aware of the high need for this trained workforce. It is, in fact, one of the top five areas all across our state where we need workers. So spending money in this area, I think, is a very wise move on behalf of the state. And I'd like to, like I said, participate with you, and maybe we can work on an amendment to include my region as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you, Representative Bolden.
Thank you so much, Representative Haley. Chair Devney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wanting to understand a little bit more the career pathways that the Bridges program offers to students, clients. I'm not sure what your terminology is. I apologize. Because while I recognize historically we've been talking Rochester and there's like no shortage of demand for people with any sort of healthcare credential in Rochester, I assume, as it builds out, how do you select, what's the process that Bridges goes through in selecting which career certification pathways you should offer and which ones you choose not to. Can you let me in on your thinking?
Ms. Whitman.
I'm happy to take that question. So I actually have the list in front of me of the current certifications that we're training for. So currently it's customer service, certified nursing assistant, home health aide, LPN, RN, phlebotomy, patient care associates, and hemodialysis technicians. So the decision on which positions that we're training for are 100% based on demand. And so we utilize our industry partners to share with us the needs that they're experiencing, as well as using labor market information to sort of forecast the needs of the future. So we're really looking at two different, data sets. One is some of that anecdotal information from our industry partners, but also the labor market information to support those, to support that information. Does that answer your question?
Sure, definitely.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. Ms. Reitman, thank you. It goes a long ways. Yes, thank you. Are you engaging with any regional economic development organizations, the MIF in the area, something like that? To, again, add to the data that you're using to make decisions.
Ms. Rittman.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. We work very closely. We have this thing in Rochester called the Destination Medical Center, and we work with a number of different economic development organizations that are all serving the Rochester area. And I do want to say that we really do look at this program as a regional program. It's not just a Rochester-centric program. A lot of the training is housed in Rochester. But these positions and these individuals are going out and working all across our region. And I think that's part of the success of this. And like I said, earlier, 60% of them are getting positions in long-term care facilities across the region as well. And we also have economic development sitting on our board, on the Workforce Development Board. And so, the short answer is yes, we work quite closely with some of those different organizations.
Chair Devin.
Thank you, Ms. Reitman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Whitman. I think Chair Devaney brought up some of the questions that I may have. Number one is, you're targeting recipients who are receiving Minnesota Family Investment Program, or known as MFIP, for those who are on the program through the state, or those who qualify for similar program. Are there any assistance that are coming from the Department of Human Services to support your program for those who are recipients of the MFIP program or participants who could have qualified?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the MFIP population is certainly one population that we recruit from and that we serve in our offices already, but that's just one of many different populations and different avenues that we use for recruitment. Our general kind of individual that comes through our door comes through the program as somebody that is typically low income, but not necessarily, on the welfare to work programs. And then also somebody who, maybe wasn't successful in traditional education for one reason or another. So many of the individuals that are coming to us have multiple barriers to employment and are somewhat behind in their education for one reason or another. So that's kind of typically our student population. I guess a lot of the individuals hear about our program from each other and through word of mouth, and then also through our Hawthorne Education Center, which is our adult basic education center in Rochester, which serves a very diverse population across the region. So they really come to us from a variety of different avenues, a variety of different populations. And then, to speak to our outreach, we're trying to serve those students that are most in need and have the most barriers to employment.
Thank you, Ms. Whitman. I think part of my conversation with the departments is, how do we figure out to utilize the existing resources in the program that are meant for individuals who qualify for TANF program, MFIP, or receiving the SNAP program, in order to give them the tools that they need? So part of my recommendation to the department, and also working with the Department of Human Services, is to create a program like the Bridges, so that we can allow people to have skills that they can find the better jobs and they can help themselves. So instead of just relying on the Workforce Development Fund, we also need to look into the funds that are available. We can utilize those resources to support individuals who qualify for the economic assistance programs through DEED. So it's something that I look forward to bringing. Maybe those are the resources that we need to be targeting, and then allowing programs like Bridges to provide more of a statewide program because of your success and helping many low-income individuals, immigrants, and those who need this type of skills is something I think we all need to be looking into and finding more creative ways and more innovative ways to utilize the resources that we already have. So instead of having silos, we need to have a uniform process of allowing everybody to have an opportunity. So with that, any other comments, members, or discussions? Seeing none, before I renew my motion, Representative Bolden, please give us any of your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Nora and members. I just really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about this program. And with your approval, I would like to ask that House File 679 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future finance bill.
Thank you so much. Go ahead.
I was just going to add that I would be happy to continue the conversation with Representative Haley about the topics that she brought up earlier.
All right. Thank you so much. I think I will be looking forward to that conversation and also finding other resources that already exist to allow this program to continue in a different revenue source that we can all rely on. So thank you so much for that. Members, I renew my motion, House File 679, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. With that, we have the final bill, House File 703, Representative Hewitt. So members, I move House File 703 to be recommended to be included in the omnibus bill. With that, Representative Hewitt, welcome to the committee and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Representative Noor. I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, committee members of the work. Your name is too long now. Anyways, I'm in the right committee. I know I am. So,
yes, you are.
Anyways,
you're in the Workforce and Business Development Committee.
Yeah, so this is a pretty straightforward bill. The legislator appropriated money for Rosemount to study a water reuse program back in 2017. And they never used the funds, but the money sat over in DEED now for several years. And they now have a new project that they want to use the funds for, but they got to have our approval to move the funds over to another account and also to extend the date so they got a little bit more time. This is a great project. I believe Logan is here from the city of Rosemount, and I would like him to kind of go into detail on what that program is, Logan, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Martin, welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Logan Martin. I'm the city administrator for the city of Rosemount. I'll give a brief introduction and then I'm joined by the city's community development director, Ms. Kim Lindquist, who will also give some more information on what we're discussing. But as Representative Hewitt mentioned, we are here today in front of your committee for a bill that would help reappropriate $700,000 in funds that was previously appropriated for a project in another city near us in Invergrove Heights that would be reappropriated in Rosemount that would allow us to study effluent reuse for an industrial project that's a heavy water user. And Ms. Lindquist can maybe go a bit further into that. But essentially, we did share some information in your packet that shows a general map of the city of Rosemount and the fact that we have a large metropolitan services pipe that runs cleaned wastewater through the city of Rosemount, 10 million gallons a day out to the Mississippi River. And what this project would propose to do would be to divert some of those gallons of water to reuse them for light industrial water cooling type purposes. So this is a demonstration project that shows that this type of work can be done, that we can repurpose cleaned wastewater prior to just exiting it into a river and instead can use it for industrial cooling type purposes and protect the precious groundwater that we have for the better uses of groundwater, of course, which would be consumption. With that, I think I can let Kim speak. Really, we've been excited about this opportunity for a number of years, and Kim will go into the fact that this is using that UMOR property that's been in the city of Rosemont for many, many years, and we've got a number of industrial users that have looked at that that property, and we feel as though this would serve as a demonstration project that sets Rosemont apart. But with that, Mr. Chair, I can turn it over to Ms. Lindquist.
Ms. Lindquist, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Kim Lindquist, the Community Development Director for the City of Rosemont. And we've been working with the University of Minnesota that owns 3,000 acres within Rosemont, the UMOR property, to entice development on that site. We've worked with the university, DEED, Greater MSP, XL Energy and the Metropolitan Council to try to come together to attract some industrial users on that parcel. One, as Mr. Logan mentioned, is a heavier water user, and the effluent pipe is a perfect opportunity to allow for sustainable growth in our community, which is something many of the users that we've been talking to are very interested in more of a green or ecological type of development. And so the use of the effluent that really just is disposed into the Mississippi River is a great benefit and of interest to many of those businesses. So what we're looking for is to be able to capture some of that effluent and use it in for this particular user, which is taking about 300, looking to take about 300 acres in the site, but would also be able to be available for kind of all the industrial in that UMOR area, which is about 900 acres. And so we feel that this is a real competitive advantage for Rosemont, the Eastern Metro, and even the state to have this type of opportunity. It's something that isn't readily available. However, we do, as Mr. Martin mentioned, feel this is a good demonstration project for other types of businesses in the metro area and outstate that have a treatment plant in their vicinity. So again, rather than discharging into an adjacent water body, that they could be able to use that effluent for coolants or irrigation, those types of things, not for potable water for drinking, but other types of water uses that would benefit the regional aquifers and benefit those other communities then that don't have that opportunity. So I think with that, we're available for questions. As I mentioned, this is something that is strongly of interest to a lot of the users that have looked at the UMOR property, and it certainly is a very sustainable and environmental issue that we really want to explore more fully. The Met Council is fully aware of this request. They've been working with us on some very preliminary engineering work, and that's what we'd be looking at is further engineering and some technical aspects in terms of how to implement this project.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Lead Hamilton, a question or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hewitt, I remember the initial project debate on the House floor. And can you go back, what happened with that initial project? Has any of the dollars been spent towards that? Why did it not work or get off the ground? Can you help us understand that a little bit before we move to the next project?
Yeah, and I think this, Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, what Maya and the city might be able to help us a little bit on this. It sounds like the project that was initially cited for this decided not to go forward. And the money just sat, it is sitting in the deed account right now. Chair Knorr, Ms. Lindquist could probably answer this a little bit better than I can.
Ms. Lindquist.
Yes, Chair, Representative, that's absolutely correct. There was a user that would have been located in Invergrove Heights, so just north of Rosemont. They had been exploring the same technology, but chose not to locate in Dakota County. And so the money has not been tapped at all. And my understanding is none of those monies were used for any type of research.
Representative Hamilton.
All right, Mr. Chairman. So all the dollars are still sitting at an account in Deed. None of them were touched. That's accurate, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Secondly, on this next proposal, who has all been involved in that to weigh in on whether or not it's a worthy investment of taxpayer dollars? And the reason I'm bringing this up is because are we doing our due diligence to gather enough information before we would make a decision to invest $700,000 into a project? Is Deed weighing in on this? Who are the entities that we've reached out on whether or not this would be viable to move ahead?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, great question. It was one that we both looked at and the city looked at also. I'm just going to give you an example of one of the high-end water users out there. I don't have to bring up the name. You can all guess who it is, but they use more water in one day than the city of Eagan does. And so these kind of projects are so essential because we need to watch the water tables in that area. And the water goes right through this area that has high power, high grid examples, and any kind of project that we're looking at out there, this would be totally suitable. We have talked to Deed. I don't know if they're here today. I thought they might be, but Deed is okay with this. The other stakeholders definitely are Rosemount that are going to make the biggest investment in getting the right user here. It's the right user at the right time at the right place, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoyt, Hewitt. Thank you. I'm not so much questioning the project as maybe I am kind of remembering again when I was on the Energy Committee and the biodiesel conversation came up that this process, if it wasn't executed with the monies that were allotted back then, I'm kind of curious why the money was just sitting there in that account without kind of getting kind of recirculated back into the Deed. Maybe it could have been used for something else. I mean, this is 5 years later, 4 years later. And so I'm just kind of, maybe if anybody is on here from Deed to maybe answer that technical question about just how, when monies are not sort of deployed and finished off, I'd rather see them, you know, stay in the account, of course. But I also, it just seems like not a good system set up here. So maybe to that question, Representative, I just want to see if anybody can answer that.
Representative Beck, I think this is a question to the nonpartisan staff to respond to the question of, I think they can give us a little bit of a background. Ms. Beckel.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. Yes, someone is here, they can certainly speak to this. So this money was set aside for a certain amount of time and we have not reached the end of that deadline. And also as part of the Minnesota Investment Fund, it was not needed elsewhere in the fund. They did not have sufficient requests or applications for funding out of the Minnesota Investment Fund to warrant looking for funds from this account that was also sort of within the Minnesota Investment Fund range.
Thank you so much, Ms. Beckel. I think this is a conversation not only for this project, Representative Baker, but a lot of projects which are sitting waiting for the funding from the Minnesota Investment Fund. We need to come up with guidelines. You'll be seeing other bills related to the MIF. We will have conversation in how we can structure long-term and also to get more involvement and more direct information how the resources for Minnesota Investment Fund is going to be used. So expect to see legislative language on some of the projects that I would stand, you know, standing out waiting for development and also for the cities because the money for MIF goes to the local government. So we have to be able to work with them to help them with their economy. So Representative Baker.
And thanks for that clarification, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this is to the nonpartisan staff again too. What is the current holding status length of that period? If this one didn't run out, is it a 10 years, 5 years? I'm just kind of curious. And I'm also wondering, the amount just happens to be the same amount that was there in the account. Does that mean the city of Rosemont is picking up the difference? Is it truly both equally amount happen to just line up, you know, just happen to be a coincidence or what? Those will be my final two questions, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Vickel.
As far as the deadline for the original appropriation, I believe it was the end of June 2021, but I may be incorrect in that. I will have to get back to you. And I'm not able to answer the second question. That would be for Representative Hewitt or the city.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I believe they're still going to have to raise some other funds to do the project. It's just that they saw this as being an area that they can explore to see if it would fit to get it done, or else basically I'm going to have to come back and ask for money, because it's the project that they have in mind is a really important project to our economic development, our business park out there that's kind of had some stutters, and it's really important to the city of Rosemont to build its tax base. So we this was a real easy road for us. Now I can go take another road, but that's kind of where we're at. And I know they're going to have to raise more money to do what they have to do. It just was money that was there that they wanted to see if they could tap.
Mr. Beck, Representative Beck, sorry.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I think to Representative Hewitt's point in the city, this sounds like a really good project. I think what it does, and again, the chair has kind of identified, we may have to relook at this, because if this were part of our omnibus bill and the project didn't go through because the extra funding couldn't be found, then when does it get restarted again? You know, we got to kind of look at the starting and stopping points of money's not able to be allocated. So that's probably not for the question for today, but I just know that those are issues that we need to kind of deal with. So I appreciate the time, Mr. Chairman and others. Thank you.
Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Hewitt, not picking on your project, right? It just brings up a lot of questions about the process that we have. And the question that I would like answered, Mr. Chairman, from Deed probably when we get that chance, is how are projects graded, if you will, or what's the difference between the earmarks that we put into our bills compared to Deed reviewing projects and then subsequently making their recommendations or funding projects? And again, that's a question for Deed, and I don't know if they're here to answer that or anybody else is, but that's a question I'd like to answer, Mr. Chairman.
Lead Hamilton, thank you so much. I think they were listening to you and they're now in the hearing. So Ms. Tannen-Dariel, anyone who can respond to that question?
Thank you, Chair Noor. Hi, members of the committee. Dariel Dannon. Oops, my dogs are going to bark. Dariel Dannon from Deed here. Yes, just jumping on real quick. So just a couple quick clarifications and then happy to answer further questions. I'm going to talk loud and hopefully my dogs will give up on this barking behind me. So we've had this funding. This was a carve out from the MIF fund. These are funds that are not scheduled to revert to the MIF account, but would revert to the general fund at the end of, as the fiscal analyst mentioned earlier, at the end of this fiscal year, so the end of 21. So if this committee or the legislature doesn't act, that's what will happen to these particular dollars. And they have been, as I sort of said, they've been sitting on our sort of bottom line for about 4 years now, or for two bienniums. So. But they can't be used. These are just not funds that could be used for MIF or any other project. So, you know, as the bill author stated, there certainly would have to be a change authorized by the legislature to allow for a different use. So hopefully that's helpful to you. And then any further questions, happy to answer.
Lynn Hamilton, follow up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, and I would like to have a further discussion on this because, you know, I'm guilty of it as well, signing on bills that we bring to this committee asking for direct appropriations or earmarks, if you will. And does that get the same amount of scrutiny as a project that would be referred and reviewed by a deed and then subsequently funded? And I guess I'd just like to understand more around that and how we're picking and choosing, we as legislators are picking and choosing these projects compared to what Deed does before it funds a project.
Thank you. Thank you, Lead Hamilton. I think that's a fair question that we will have to bring those conversation when we have a hearing on MIF and some of the other programs for redevelopment projects. So stay tuned. You'll have that bill, and hopefully DEED can do a thorough process of informing us and engaging us in how they do their process, and if we do through legislative process compared to DEED taking the lead in terms of those projects that are chosen by these programs. So with that, don't see any other hand. Would like to ask Representative Hugh to give us his closing remarks. I think he may have, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, committee members, for a good discussion. And Representative Hamilton, I would never think that you were attacking a project of mine.
Thank you.
I appreciate the, but I think that this is definitely a project that I think could happen in any of our communities, especially those that have situations like this where the water is discharged in their district. So I look forward to more discussion on this. I hope we can get it through this year. I would like to see Rosemount use this water and use this project soon. So moving forward, I thank the committee and thank you, Representative. Thank you, Chair Noor. I love to say that for hearing the bill.
Thank you so much, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this bill forward. I know we have conversations and decisions to make. So with that, I renew my motion to lay House File 703 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, that was the last bill in our agenda. There are no any other further discussions. With that, the meeting is now adjourned. Thank you so much for joining us.